This is First Draft, a dialogue on writing. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. This is a show about craft, the writing life, and the themes that are present in a writer's work. Every interview is a journey. I don't really know where our conversation is going to go, but I do know that it's fascinating every time, and one way or another, we seem to get around to what it means to be human and how through craft, that idea is articulated on the page. Thank you for joining me on this literary pilgrimage into the mind of one writer at a time. My interview today is with Diane Suess, author of the poetry collection Modern Poetry.
This book is a hard voyage. And in ways it's intellectual, and in ways it's spiritual, and in ways it's deeply, deeply personal.
We'll be back with Diane Suess after these essential words. Here's what I want to say about pitching for patrons. It's my least favorite thing to do, but it supports my most favorite thing to do. Share this podcast with the world and with you. And so I'm wondering, do you get something out of this? Do you listen more than 8 times a year? Is there something of value for you in these episodes? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then why not support this content by becoming a patron of First Draft? You can do that at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Here's the common conversation I have at parties. Okay, I don't really go to parties because I'm always doing this, but this is a common conversation I have about this podcast. So why did you start this? Someone asks. I don't really know. I was a radio reporter for years and getting my MFA in fiction, and I missed interviewing people. So I combined these two things and started this show. I didn't really think about what I was doing. I didn't have a master plan. It just seemed like a fun idea at the time. And I still don't really have a master plan, but it's been 10 years that I've been doing this. So then they asked, do you make money? And the answer is, I have some incredible patrons, but they come and go. And lately, for whatever reason, and this is really vulnerable here, more people have left than joined. I can't pretend to know why, but in exit surveys, they usually say it's for financial reasons and that they really love the content. And I get that. I really get it because there are expenses to make this podcast and financial needs to make this podcast. I will say that every hour I'm working on this is time I'm not spending at a quote unquote paying gig. Times have changed since we got our newspapers on our stoops twice a day. You know that. Our content comes from all over the place. But in this case, there isn't an AI behind this, just an I, which is me, Mitzi, all by my lonesome, doing the research, booking the guests, reading their work, conducting the interview, uploading it into the podcast world, and then doing it again and again and again, more than 50 times in the last year. I produce one episode a week, and that is on top of all my other jobs, which is why I don't go to parties or really do anything on the weekends except for this. So if you value this podcast, please consider supporting it with a financial contribution. Membership starts at $6 a month and includes extras like writing tips, cuts that didn't make it into the final show, end of the year thank you gifts, ad-free, pitch-free episodes so you won't have to hear this again, and more. I think in this world, we have to support what we love, and there is an energy there that comes back to us. So please go to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters and become a supporter of First Draft today. It still doesn't make a shred of sense that I'm doing this podcast. Still, here I am after a decade. But Rumi said, set your life on fire. Seek those who fan your flames. So I'm inviting you to warm yourself by this fire and bring your fan along. Patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. And on to the show. My guest today is poet Diane Suess, author of 6 books of poetry, including Frank Sonnets, which won the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Critics Circle Award, and the Los Angeles Book Prize, among other awards. Other collections include Still Life with 2 Dead Peacocks and a Girl and 4-Legged Girl. She was a 2020 Guggenheim Fellow, and in 2021, she received the John Updike Award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. She lives in Michigan. Her collection, Modern Poetry, investigates poetry itself and Suess's relationship to the form and her belief in the art. Many of the poems in the collection make use of the forms and terms of musical and poetic craft, like ballad, fugue, aria, refrain, and coda, and contend with writers overrepresented in textbooks and those too often underrepresented. Through the content of the poems, she is also investigating her history and her relationship to modernism and romanticism and objectivity. We began the interview with Diane Seuss sharing how modern poetry began.
When I came to this book, you know, I had finished Frank and doing sonnets for 3 years. I knew that with every book I do, I don't want to do the same thing twice. I want to take a turn, a big turn, a big leap. And for this book, I was feeling very different from the way I felt when I was writing Frank. I'd been isolating like everybody else for a long time, and I live alone. And so there's that due to, you know, COVID, which, you know, nobody wants to hear that word anymore. And the political situation in this country that we all share, really demoralizing for many of us. And I began to wonder, what can poetry be up against this? I realized that even though I've always been a person who writes in solitude, having been a professor, having been around the young, having sort of being kind of a gregarious seeming person, fed my poems in certain ways. So this all set me up to need to think about, where do I go from here? The state of mind of Frank, even when it was dealing with difficult stuff, there was a playfulness, a lightheartedness, an experimental vibe. And that was no longer my situation. That was no longer our situation. And we, you know, writers have to respond to the times and to their own evolution as souls. So now I can talk about structure. and that is that I decided to write longer poems, obviously, to not do sonnets. There is only one form in the book, and that's a kind of experiment with the ballad. I write a few ballads in the book. But for some reason, I was called to titling after kinds of music, because I think with all of the argumentation I do in the book about poetry's veracity and power or lack thereof, there's something about the music of poetry that persists. And even before I had sort of written my way through the book's trajectory, that does land somewhere positive, I think, about poetry through a big struggle, I knew that I needed something kind of in the background to keep me going. And music itself, the lyric mode, stood in, I guess, for the sonnet in a sense that, you know, it became a thing to hold me up through the process of writing the book. And there is a structure that, you know, the first poem is called Little Fugue State. So it's both looking, you know, sort of a takeoff on the fugue, which is a kind of music, a kind of construction or composition, and the fugue state that many of us have been in of languishment through the isolation of the pandemic. And I mean, that's a pretty It's a very lyrical poem. It's a very rhymey poem, but it also it's a deathy poem. It ends, "This dog I've walked and walked to death." So that's the beginning. It begins with some shorter poems, really questioning, Curl, which is a short poem, which I think is maybe second in the book. It asks, can you even hide from creation, from what we've made inside a poem? Can you hide inside a poem? Can you protect yourself from what we've made inside what we've made? So it goes from that question to poems on my own education, my own spotty, strange, circular education, or lack thereof. And then, it takes us through, I guess, even in poems that almost work as essays that have a rhetorical edge, poems called poetry or poems called against poetry or called love letter, which is sort of against love letters. It takes us through a kind of argument where I'm testing out poetry. I'm putting it under the microscope as a way of finally being able to be honest with myself about this thing I based my entire life on, that in a lot of ways I gave up everything for. And does it mean, can it matter? And in the last section of the book, I think I come to the answer, and it's yes. But I had to go through the process.
You know, when I think about the first page, which is the little fugue state, and the last poem, which is called Romantic Poet.
Yes.
And you talk about romance in various forms throughout this. And so
yes.
I feel like you're moving towards the romantic, but that doesn't mean you don't have arguments with it in the midst of it, but that
yes.
you start off very unmoored and lost, and you end up maybe acknowledging that that's an okay place to be and that you can still love like where you are.
Yes. Yeah. There's the book is called Modern Poetry, which is kind of a takeoff on textbooks and periods of development, I guess, in poetry, and my sort of entryway into poetry through modernism. But I kind of, as you say, I walk my way toward romantic poetry and Keats especially. And what he has for me that maybe I didn't find until late in the day in what is called modernism. So my companion, I guess I'll say, through the process of arguing my way across the landscape in this book was Keats, not Frank O'Hara. And Keats, who died young, who was plagued with the plague of the time, tuberculosis, who died at, 24, 25? Who never got the chance to write everything, he'd just be gone. And that has a real personal connection to me with my father, who died very young, and Frank O'Hara, who died young, and Mickle, who was on the cover of Frank, my sort of soul buddy, deep friend, who died of AIDS very young. So I've always been sort of interested and struggled with that trope and the romantic tragic, I guess I'd say. I sort of find my way there in the process of this book. Keats' description of what he called negative capability, which was the writer's capacity for not knowing, for living in mystery, is the condition, I guess, of excellence. for him. He had a lot to teach me, and I fell in love with him. Some of this book is about giving up on love, but I fell in love with him. Sort of the young me fell in love with the young him, the girl on the cover of modern poetry. And even love, then, in the last section of the book, is put under scrutiny, sort of from Keats' point of view, and becomes something else entirely than romance, you know? So what am I saying? This book is a hard voyage. And it's, and in ways, it's intellectual. And in ways, it's spiritual. And in ways, it's deeply, deeply personal. It might not feel as sort of as much like an autobiography as Frank, but it is. It's just, in certain ways, the autobiography of ideas.
I felt like Frank was more anecdotes and parts of your life that were creating this whole, and you had told me it was autobiographical, but this one, I felt like it was more of like a long, continuous discussion, and in some ways was maybe like deeper, and even in some ways maybe darker, even though there was some,
it is darker.
There was dark stuff in Frank. It's, I could see how it could be more personal. And one of the things I really walked away with, I mean, there was a lot in here, was it had a lot to do for me about aging and the person that you have become and the way that you sort of look at your emotions, let go of them in a certain way, like what age brings you. But I mean, you have arguments in there about wisdom, so I don't want to say it's about wisdom, but there is something about aging that struck me.
I think that's very true. Yes. I've always been interested, even in Four-Legged Girl, which was my third book, I've always been interested in sort of coldness as a middle ground, as a way of finding middle ground. Because my young emotional life was very intense and very warm, very vulnerable. And there's something to be said of objectivity. And I think in aging, I have come just through sheer necessity to a deeper form of objectivity. Keats expresses it in a poem toward the end of the book. You know, I do it through him, but that's, I think just my relationship to romantic love, for instance, is echoed in what he comes to kind of as a ghost at the end of the book. So, yes, I think a kind of cool wisdom, not romanticizing poetry or human beings or love, but coming to an understanding of love that is larger, really, than I've had in the past.
We'll be back with this interview in just a moment. Remember, you can listen to this and every episode without ads and without these pitches by becoming a patron of First Draft at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. I don't know why I got this out of your poem, Little Fugue with Jean Seberg and Tupperware.
And I had a feeling you'd ask me about that one.
It can be something that you read, but my note that I wrote after it, and I don't exactly know why, is I wrote a sense that age has erased all pretense for you and that it's coming into your power. It's not necessarily, from my perspective, was all objectivity. It was like having your power and being able to say what you hate, where politeness is gone. I don't know if that was the word when you're young, but when you're just more obsequious or you don't have those boundaries, I did feel like there's like a power in how you feel now.
Oh, I love that. You get me, girl. You get me. Yeah. Probably the poem in the book that is the most overt in that way is a poem called Rhapsody, which is really naughty. But yes, and it's true in the Tupperware Jean Seberg poem about the movie Breathless, too. Just an overtness about my own judgments of things. And I've never been great at lying, but I also have had a Midwestern kind of niceness. And I still suffer from that probably too much. But in this book, I put that away. You're right. If I needed anything, I needed honesty. I needed to offer myself honesty and thereby the reader. So I think you've nailed it.
Yeah, and the poem right before that, you say in Rhapsody, which we can read, it's quite long. I also had some notes from that, but your last word is, don't be the savior, be the stain, which seems to like be in a way yourself speaking to that Midwestern person. Like, you can stop being that person. Like, in actuality, like, maybe it is the stain that people remember. That's the voice shouting out from the chorus of the status quo. The stain is saying, I'm different than everything else.
Yeah. Well, and I'm talking about the Shroud of Turin. And what lasts on that shroud is the stain. Not the salvation, but the stain. And the stain of the body. And I love that. Yeah, I think I have, in the last couple of books, I've really thought about legacy, which is strange. Maybe another thing you think about when you're aging. And I sort of like the legacy of clear-sighted honesty, not with the intention of doing harm, but especially in poems, it seems high time. I don't want to write poems that are prescriptive about sort of how to live or how to reach for the light or any of that stuff. If I prescribe anything, I want it to be honesty. And, you know, that can be harsh. It can be harsh, but I think it's also maybe in a time of so-called fake news. I really wanted to write a book that didn't do that. I like books of poems where the speaker isn't the hero and isn't heroic. Even my father in this book, who has always been a heroic or sacrificial sort of force, in this book, the poem Pop Song, he comes to me as and the woman I am now in sort of a nice to see you, like he would an acquaintance. He's lost touch with me. He just doesn't care that much. He's been dead for 50 years, you know, or more. And what is that? You know, that just seemed like a really interesting place to have arrived, that, you know, where I've romanticized him for my whole life, to suddenly realize that we're not, in reality, we're not all that connected anymore. That he might come back to me and judge me for the woman I am now.
I felt like that was another meaning found in the container of these poems, was that shedding the misconceptions of the world that youth represented. And though you didn't know at the time, you don't have apologies for that now. And it's not like there's not a nostalgia for that or anything. It's just saying like, it's like a passage into something where there isn't guilt, where there isn't like looking back and thinking, oh, I should have thought differently. It's just like a shedding.
Mm-hmm. Yes, a shedding of the skin, and a necessary one. We all do it, I imagine. You know, we all shed those skins eventually. Luckily, I guess, I have the capacity to put that into language.
But I think sometimes as we age, like you're saying, like with your father, that you realize you didn't really know him and that, you know, you maybe held him a certain way your whole life. I think we can do that with so many things, like that we loved school or that we had a certain relationship that meant so much. And we kind of, when we really look at our lives later, and maybe time is a big element in that, that you can't yeah. escape, we kind of have to come to terms with the paradigm that we've shaped our life around is either wrong or it's just shifted, and that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I noticed that I started thinking of my dead people like I imagine, you know, all my father has not seen or been part of. Al Mickle, my friend on the cover of Frank, who died in the 80s, has missed, especially the last 10 years, I would say, of, you know, tyranny. And how, when I think of him now, or my dad, they seem really, and this is something that I deal with a lot in this book, they seem sort of innocent. And an innocence in this book is not necessarily a positive any more than it was for, say, William Blake in the way that he communicated innocence and experience. There's something to be said for experience. And there's some in the first ballad in the book, I talk about sort of trying out my innocence with my mother when she tells me my father is dead. There's a cruelty almost in innocence. When I think of my dad now, there's a kind of thinness of spirit just because of the time that's lapsed and the evolution they weren't forced to endure. That sounds sort of harsh, maybe. But it just puts space between us, between them and myself, in a way that I can't hold them with as much sentimentality or intimacy as I have in the past.
I would love for you to read if you feel like something that represents what we've been saying so far.
Mm-hmm.
I love the ballad that ends with bitch.
Ballad that ends with bitch. She was one of those long-nosed ones, merry, full of grace, cream atop the milk. I picked my way through dung piles and bones, animal dung, animals of every ilk. All of us come with a ballad. Hers was set in an Amish puppy mill, born in a mill, then forced to give birth. Birth before she'd been a year on this cold earth. She rolled on her back to show me her scar. Playing dead, she showed me her spaying scar. I have one of those, I said, but mine is perpendicular. Little princess, I too have been opened with a crowbar. My tenderness. I couldn't find a way to say yes. I felt splayed, my little scar exposed. It's all against our will, I suppose. I stumbled through brambles to find my way, I guess. A whole pathless hillside covered in sedge. Barn cats arch their backs, neutralizing agents, agents of indifference. Other animals pawed at the gate, looking to get in or out of grace or fate. I walked her, using a piece of rope for a leash. She knew nothing of a leash, that false umbilical cord. On that tether, she wandered aimless, trampish, too small for this world, vast as a billboard. I was once too small for this world. Somebody burned my arm with a cigar. They said they didn't know I was there. I believed them. I still have the scar. She was a prototype of tenderness. I wandered that hillside this way and that. I could not find my way to yes. She was a child bride in a plastic creche. As I drove away, her borders dissolved. She dispersed herself across the landscape like mist. Through the fog, I could still see her belly scar, a horizon line, I told myself, divvying up that and this. When I returned to my digs, the house was frozen stiff, a fine skim of hoarfrost on the writing desk. Why call it a writing desk? It's commerce covered. Bills, tat, that, this. At age 10, I turned away from tenderness. I remember the moment, a flipping of a switch. My house was a cold mess, except for that thing in the corner. Poetry, that snarling, flaming bitch.
I love that. It's at the end, it holds so much in that very last four lines about turning away from this tenderness, and that your emotions flipped a switch. And I was thinking about your dad dying, and
yes,
and that poetry is like there for you, but it's fraught also.
Yeah. And again, I mentioned it earlier, there's that coldness. My house is a cold mess, except for that thing in the corner. Poetry, that snarling, flaming bitch. You know, there's a heat there, but it isn't like warm and cuddly. I couldn't say yes to this dog that I met. You know, a rescue dog, not the one I have now, but I couldn't get to yes. She was perfect. And I just couldn't do it. And when I got home, I wrote this poem that what I was left with was that flaming bitch in the corner, you know, poetry. And I love not romanticizing it there. Oh, but I have my poems, you know. No, it's a hell of a bitch to live with. And it snarls.
Do you think that if your father hadn't died, you would have been a poet?
You know, my mom and I have talked about that. Even before he died, I had a thing for language. I tended toward, I read at age 3, and I was one of those kids who just reads. It was automatic. And I tended toward rhyminess in my head and meter. So that was there. And he, one of the few things I remember is that he was really proud of my ability to read so young. And when people would come to see him when he was sick, he would, and I was there, he'd say, "Di, read them, the newspaper." So I think it was there, but I don't think I would have needed it as badly. You know, usually when you talk to poets, you find that most of us, I think, especially in childhood, have faced some sort of a hole or mystery. I'll just say mystery. That, and you know, maybe you could say all kids face that in one way or another. But if we have that facility with language, it the hole beckons, I guess. So it's hard to know but I think I would have done something with communication, but I may not have needed poetry as much as I did.
What did your sister do?
Interesting. She was older, and her response to my dad was, well, the first ballad in the book, you see her response. She like hits me with her flute case because I'm crying when they come to pick me up from school. And when we didn't get to go see him in the hospital very often, but when we did, she was very angry, and she'd sort of sit and watch TV with her arms folded over her chest. She knew to use anger to protect herself. And yet, she became a hospice nurse, and she accompanied people toward their deaths. So spiritually, I think she has it all over on me. And hospice nurses and teachers don't get the same sort of opportunities for interviews and, you know, all that.
I'm wondering if you can read the poem Weeds.
Weeds. The danger of memory is going to it for respite. Respite risks entrapment, which is never good. Don't debauch yourself by living in some former version of yourself that was more or less naked. Maybe it felt better then, but you were not better. You were smaller, as the rain gauge must fill to the brim with its full portion of suffering. What can memory be in these terrible times? Only instruction, not a dwelling. Or if you must dwell, the sweet smell of warm weeds then. The sweet smell of warm weeds now. An endurance, a standoff, a rest.
I love that because it kind of relates to that idea of like shedding and not sort of living with this false paradigm and not sort of living in your memory as it is a place to dwell. You're saying learn from it and move on.
Yes.
Yeah.
Don't get entrapped, which I've been through a good deal of my life. Nostalgia was seen as a sickness in war soldiers. And people and men were said to die of nostalgia. Nostalgia can be another sort of a synonym for depression. You know, everything that I'd based my survival on in this book, I decided to come up against, to argue with. You know, memory has always been extremely important to me in my poems. And in Weeds, I say it's dangerous. It can entrap. Don't debauch yourself by living in some former version of yourself that was more or less naked. Innocence, again, you know. Maybe it felt better, but you were not better. You were smaller, as the rain gauge must fill to the brim with its full portion of suffering. You know, you weren't all the way cooked.
Yeah, and I think sometimes memory can leave us, for some people it leaves them very joyous, but I think there's also a loneliness because it seems like when you're looking at a memory, there's two of you there. There's the person that you are now and the person you are in that memory. Even if it wasn't happening to you, you're still a witness to that memory. And when you extricate yourself from that memory, you can feel so much more alone. And it's so visceral.
Yes, that's very true, Mitzi. I guess because I was so alone through the years of writing this book, I challenged myself to face that aloneness without the sort of perverse assistance of nostalgia or memory used to convince myself that I wasn't alone.
I wonder if you can read the last poet, so the last poem, romantic poet.
Sure. Romantic poet. You would not have loved him, my friend the scholar, he cried. He brushed his teeth, if at all, with salt. He lied and rarely washed his hair, wiped his ass with leaves or with his hand. The top of his head would have barely reached your tits. His pits reeked, as did his deathbed. But the nightingale, I said.
Yeah, tell me more about that.
Oh, well, it really happened. I told a friend of mine that I was falling for Keats as I was writing this book. And she's a scholar of that period of literature. And she said, you would have hated him. He was tiny and he, you know, didn't brush his teeth and he lied and he this. And then I was also reading the Keats biography and kind of gleaned the ass wiping and stuff. And you know, it's sort of a microcosm of what the whole book does with poetry, which is, yeah, there's this wrong and this wrong and this wrong and this wrong, but he wrote the fucking nightingale, I said. You know, the song. And that means I love it. I love it, him being it, being poetry, despite everything.
Yeah, it was such a beautiful way to end. And I have such a memory of being in my first poetry class because I was an English major and I had to take poetry and I was afraid of it. And
yeah,
I didn't really understand that poem. And then we like deconstructed it in class and just talking about this sheer ecstasy and joy he feels at seeing this nightingale. And right alongside it is the idea of death and that, yep. You know, living, that the greatest ecstasy that you can feel is the ephemerality of our life. And you couldn't feel that if death wasn't so near. And I've never forgotten that. I was that class. I was in my 20s. That was like over 30 years ago. But it like turned a switch for me to understand that.
And to think that he wrote that, you know, he was barely not a teenager, and that he was able to see that, feel it, that he defied innocence, really. It's just amazing to me. I mean, it's more amazing to me than anything religion ever offered me.
We'll be back with this interview in just a moment. Remember, you can listen to this and every episode without ads and without these pitches by becoming a patron of First Draft at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Can you read something by an author that influences you as a writer?
Yeah, you probably won't be surprised. This is by John Keats, and it's a sonnet. When I have fears that I may cease to be, before my pen has gleaned my teeming brain, before high-piled books in charactery hold like rich garners the full ripened grain, when I behold upon the night's starred face huge cloudy symbols of a high romance, and think that I may never live to trace their shadows with the magic hand of chance. And when I feel, fair creature of an hour, that I shall never look upon thee more, never have relish in the fairy power of unreflecting love, then on the shore of the wide world, I stand alone and think, till love and fame to nothingness do sink.
Do you want to say anything more about that?
The ideas and feelings in that poem are really what I wanted to accordion out and explore in modern poetry. The artfulness, the musicality teach me so much. And also that he's not willing. So he begins, when I have fears that I may cease to be, you know, here's this young man fearing dying before I have a chance to finish my work. That's a terrible fear. He knew that he had work to do. He had poems to write. And then, you know, at the turn, at the volta, when I feel fair creature of an hour, I assume Fanny Braun, that I shall never look upon thee more, never have relish in the fairy power of unreflecting love. I love that. You know, he was beginning to sort of take love apart there. Then on the shore of the wide world, I stand alone and I think. I mean, this book is about standing alone and thinking. Till love and fame to nothingness do sink. And that's negative capability enacted. The willingness to end a sonnet on nothingness, especially then, it's just amazing to me.
Can you read something you wrote that was tricky or hard or changed a lot from the first draft or something you like?
Yeah, I hope this is a little longer than Keats, but it's a direct reflection of that poem. And it was hard to work out while writing it, but very satisfying to work out. It's called High Romance, which is a phrase in the poem I just read. And then Keats' ghost found that he could no longer love Fanny Braun. He'd escaped the body like a love letter from its envelope, and he'd flown like a love letter in a windstorm. He'd seen that the words formed from ink melted in the rain. Words he now knew, and he'd once been such a devotee, didn't matter so much as he'd believed they mattered. Something mattered, he knew, but whatever it was, he couldn't put words to it, or he didn't have the heart to put words to it. He did feel love, but it was an arrow without a target. It was diffuse, like an atomized perfume, or stars as the poor see them, who cannot afford glasses. He saw that Fanny, as she was known, was a concept, just as he had been a concept. They each inhabited the same amount of space, like a tablespoon of butter and a tablespoon of lard. In a book, they would each occupy a single page. Their brains encased in cranial bones and flesh and heads of hair could each rest on a single silk pillow. Ideas, he found, don't die. Even notions fly like cottonwood seeds through the air. And love had been a notion. He saw that Fanny in time would slip free of herself. Everything does in time, even roses, even stones, foothills, fleas, and poems. Rhyme, he saw, existed on its own behalf. He could catch it, like a bird catches an air current. From above, he could see that Fanny was not trifling. Nothing from above is trifling, nor more compelling than anything else. His love for her, he saw, had been an invention of the mind. Only belief could sustain it, but he could no longer sustain belief. Now and then he'd try it on again, love, like a fancy hat he could not afford, and now appeared ludicrously over-designed. Once his ghost managed to look at her again, through the gauzy curtains that hung over her bedroom window. His gaze was too objective to find her beautiful. But objectivity itself, that was beautiful.
Do you want to say anything about that?
I never thought I'd make my way to objectivity and find it beautiful. I really like the idea of thinking about how the dead reassess, not just the living, but their own kind of foibles and the thickness of feelings when they were alive. I love the idea of Keats' ghost realizing he's too objective to find all the things he found in Fanny when he was alive, but that objectivity was a kind of beauty. And Keats was always, you know, for him, beauty was truth.
Where do you write?
I write right where I'm sitting now, which is I'm sitting on my couch. My computer is on a table in front of me. My dog is on the carpet, just in my house on the couch. Nothing fancy.
What do you do or where do you go to get away from writing?
You know, I don't feel like I ever am away from writing. I am writing. If I'm not writing with my fingers, I'm writing in my head. But I do like taking kind of a drive without a destination. I can kind of empty out then.
Who do you show your work to first to get feedback?
Usually my son. He lives way north in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And he is a really good critic of my work because he knows me so well. He knows even a word that has bullshit in it. He knows it.
How have you dealt with rejection?
I don't expect acceptance. I don't think I ever did. That seemed outside my purview. So, you know, I mean, my first 9,000 years, I got a lot of rejection. And my mentor, who was a wonderful poet who kind of found me, he was just so casual about it all. He'd say, you know, back then you sent it in hard copy with a self-addressed envelope. And he'd say, oh, you know, you'll get it back many times and just put it back in another envelope and send it out again. No big deal. And so I just came to see it as no big deal. I mean, I didn't have a second book until 10 years after my first book. And my second book was rejected many times. And then it won the Juniper Prize, which was great. It opened up the world to me. Four-Legged Girl was rejected before I ended up at Gray Wolf Press. So I would just say, I guess, for other poets, don't see rejection as such a bad thing or as any kind of judgment on your ultimate career. See it as just another day at the office. And also, take it in and make the work better. I mean, every time my book would get rejected, I just weed it out and put in new stuff and think about why it wasn't getting taken. You know, you have to kind of get egoless about it. So I'm fine with that.
And what is your favorite word?
This is always hard for me, but I'm going to say penetralium, which was a word that Keats invented in his letter to his brothers, in which he described his notion of negative capability. And it meant the most secret part of something, the inner chamber. It's probably something he thought about vaginas. but I love the idea of the penetralium where mystery resides. And in fact, there's a poem in modern poetry called Penetralium. I like how penetrate is part of that. It's just a kind of strange, funky, perverse word.
Well, thank you so much for your time. So generous of you. Thank you.
You're welcome. And thank you for getting me. Yeah. Thank you for getting these poems.
If you like today's show with Diane Seuss, author of the poetry collection Modern Poetry, check out my interview with her on her Pulitzer Prize winning collection, Frank. We talked about language eclipsing feeling, not knowing where a poem is going, and her refusal to get baptized. You can find that interview and the entire First Draft archive of more than 450 interviews at firstdraftwriters.com. You can stay tuned to First Draft on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just look for First Draft ADOW. You can email me at firstdraftwriters@gmail.com anytime. Remember, there are plenty of extras for becoming a member and donating to First Draft, including access to pitch-free, ad-free content, as well as cuts from the interviews that didn't make it into the final show, writing tips from my guests, books, and more. Join me as I reach for honesty, vulnerability, connection, curiosity, and insights on craft with each episode. I can't tell you enough how much each and every single dollar counts to keeping this show alive. The first tier of support is just $6 a month, so please go to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Coming up in the next few months on First Draft, interviews with Tommy Orange, Deborah Spark, and Kylie Reed. I want to send out a huge thank you to my patrons for making this interview happen. Your support makes First Draft, a dialogue on writing, a reality every week. Please stay healthy and safe. The theme music for First Draft was produced and performed by Murph Mahaffey. I'm your host and producer, Mitzi Rapkin. Thank you for listening.